This is an interview with Mrs. Celia Perry, who experienced the effects of the Great Depression of the 1930s in both San Diego and San Francisco. This interview is taking place in her home in San Diego, California. The interviewer is Jim Dacus, and the date is December 15th, 1973. Okay, Ms. Perry, could you first tell us a little bit about your background? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was about, 11 years old, and I was living in San Francisco with my mother and with a lady friend. And we were living there temporarily until we moved to San Diego, during which time my mother thought it would be a good idea to go to work. She had never worked before. And her lady friend had worked in the laundry, so she introduced my mother to working in a laundry. And this was the first time that we had been separated from my father. And so it was quite an experience for me as a child, and as well as for my mother working. And I remember her working. She was receiving something like $26 a week.
I see. So in 1929, then you were where then, in San Francisco?
I was in San Francisco.
And then how long were you there?
Oh, up until 32, 33.
And then you moved down
to San Diego.
So the first effects
of the
depression were up in San Francisco.
And at that time, I remember people speaking of the depression. I remember there was free milk at school for children.
Right.
If we bought our decanters, we could take it home. I remember a bread was 5 cents a loaf.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was just at the beginning when sliced bread came on the market. It was the first time sliced bread was introduced. And I remember some of the old timers saying they would never eat bread that was sliced by a machine. And they thought the world was coming to an end because of the slice theory.
Okay. So how would you say then that the onset, how did you first notice the onset of the depression? How did it?
Well, actually, at home we ate well. All I knew is that I could hear the grown-ups speak of it.
Yeah.
And that food was cheaper because of the fact that money was scarce.
Right.
And we heard of families that, were very depressed and needed aid.
You mentioned that food was a lot cheaper after the market had crashed. Can you remember some examples, like how much?
Oh, I think like bread was 5 cents, and I think.
And what was it before? Before
well, I couldn't remember. I was quite young.
But more than.
But the only reason I remember this is because when I came to San Diego. In 32, we found that the area was more depressed than San Francisco. Wages were lower than San Francisco, and food costs were higher.
Oh my gosh!
The imbalance there was. Then we really felt the difference.
So you really noticed it right away, the difference.
The moment we hit San Diego, yes.
Okay.
And Mother worked again in a laundry. And the same work she was doing in San Francisco for $24 to $26 a week, she was getting $15 here.
Yeah,
it's a good $10 reduction in salary.
And it didn't go as far.
And it didn't go as far, no. So we felt the depression in San Diego more so than San Francisco because of the fact that San Francisco was a unionized city, and it seemed like the unions kept the standard of living higher than in San Diego,
right,
where a union was not even introduced.
Okay, well, when you were up in San Francisco, no, let's say San Diego, when you got in here to San Diego, did you observe any real suffering around you, people that were really having a tough time getting enough food?
We lived in a good average neighborhood. I would say the Hillcrest area, which was a very good family neighborhood. We did not live in the depressed areas, although people We knew people who, we knew a family that were receiving welfare, and because there were so many in the family, there were like eight in the family, and there was only one person working. Jobs were scarce.
Right.
Some people even volunteered their services just for food. That's how bad
right.
it was.
So what? How do you remember how these people were suffering? Like
yes, they had limited clothing. They had hand-me-downs that were really bad, and they had to eat very, very staple foods.
Right.
A lot of soups and a lot of starchy foods in order to, you know, last. And we weren't not depressed like that. My mother worked, and we lived within our means. We never got any aid because of the fact that we were only two, and we were quite proud not wanting, you know.
Right, right.
And that was the case with many families that would go out and work. And I know at one time my mother had to hold down two jobs in order to make a full week. And she'd work, you know, like in one laundry close by home and then another one way downtown
right.
in order to make a full week. It's, and I think it holds true today that if you really want to work, you can find work.
Right, okay. Well, prior to when things got bad, did you do you remember anyone saying anything about how they thought things were going to get bad, any indications that things were going to get
well, tough? Being such a young child, I wouldn't be aware of this, you see, because I was, what, 11, 10 years old, you know, maybe 9 years old when the big crash.
Right.
See, I was born 1918, so I was really 9 years old when the crash came.
Right.
And I know a lot of people who had, we had heard of people who had money in the stock market, lost everything. You heard of people committing suicide, and of course I was not directly affected by this because my folks did not have money in the stock market, so this did not affect them.
Okay, but nothing like in the nothing like say in newspapers or magazines or anything about predicting.
No, I wouldn't. I would be too young to be reading a newspaper,
right.
You know.
Okay. And you don't remember any friends or relatives or anyone saying anything about it?
Well, other than just indirectly through family that, you know, so-and-so had lost their earnings through the stock market and now they had to do without, you know, certain luxuries and things like that, you know.
Right. Okay. Okay, let's move on here to some...
Everybody seemed to cut corners.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. How did people get by then during those years? How did they make ends meet with it?
Well, for one thing, of course you must realize that the family life was entirely different than it is today. To begin with, people enjoyed more togetherness with their family and friends. And I think this helped them live through the Depression, the fact that they didn't have to have automobiles, they didn't have to be traveling, they didn't have to go out for their entertainment and diversion, that this was all done within the family. The family life really sustained a lot of people.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you'd...
Everyone stuck together.
Yes, and families would get together and, you know, you could... there were different things you could do together. You know, you could play cards, you could play a bingo or
right.
things
well,
like that.
Well, did people help each other out, too, or I've heard...
Well, if you knew someone that had a job or there was a possibility, you always try to help your friends get located. I know a lot of times, well, not in our instance, because like I say, it was just the two of us, but I know many cases like they would always try to have someone over for dinner. I know only in one experience that we had, there were some girls that were nurses, and they, we'd invite them once a week over to come over and have spaghetti den, and that was a very popular dinner, by the way, during the Depression.
Yeah.
And we'd have them over for spaghetti dinner. There were three girls, and so it wasn't so costly, and we could afford it. I know a hamburger was like 10 cents a pound, and for about 50 cents, you could have a dinner for several people, a spaghetti dinner.
Really?
Uh-huh.
This is when? About?
About 36, 35, around there.
36.
35,
okay.
34, around there.
Right. Okay, so you were going to school, public schools then, were you?
Yes, I went to Roosevelt Junior High and San Diego High.
Okay, how did that affect life in the schools? I've heard that a lot of children had to drop out and help support the family in some way.
Some of them were, yes, they were, and a lot of the students I can remember. And although I never received that kind of help, like I say, we were proud and we wanted to work and earn our own way too. I remember some of them receiving tickets for lunch, you know, would get free lunches.
Right.
And some would get their gym clothes purchased, you know, through the school, aid. There were different kind of aids that would try to help, you know, the different families. But
well, would you say that?
I didn't live in such a depressed area. You must remember Roosevelt Junior High was in a very nice area. Hillcrest is a nice area. And I imagine, though, in the other areas, I remember my mother speaking about people she knew that.
What areas were these in St. Louis?
Down in the southern part of the city, you know.
Yeah.
Like around National Avenue, places like that.
That was, it was pretty bad around there.
Yes, it was, because, you know, the jobs were scarce.
Yeah, okay. So you did notice that children in school were having to get this kind of aid, and wouldn't it ever notice any instances of children having to drop out? Any of your friends or anything like that have to drop out?
No, none of our friends.
Most of our
people are pretty independent. We found ways of economizing and working and making ends meet.
Okay. You mentioned that your mother had a job. She worked in the laundries. Did she have a hard time getting a job?
It was very difficult to get jobs. And it was very competitive, and you'd work like 10 hours sometimes. And the pay was very, very, very poor, and conditions weren't even good, working conditions. It was the only reason we could compare is because she came from San Francisco and then to San Diego and did the same work, and it was just an entirely different atmosphere.
Yeah.
The attitude of the managers towards the help was really, at times,
degrading,
yes. And you just had to take it because it meant holding on to your job.
In what sense? Do you remember
her? Well, like, they were never satisfied. They would always want more out of you, and they wouldn't allow you to have a break even to go to the restroom. You weren't allowed that. Your lunch hour was a half an hour. It was just like it really, I mean, it was such a difference with San Francisco.
So
not that she didn't work as hard, it's just that the attitude and the morale was different. There was such a low morale here.
Right.
I'm very sorry to say, even though the climate was beautiful and the city was beautiful and we loved it, but the morale of the attitude of the employers and the employees was entirely different.
Right, okay. So when she was, what you're saying is, first of all, it was easier to find employment up in San Francisco, and then harder down here.
It was somewhat. I think the fact that well, I won't say it was somewhat easier. Yes. San Francisco was easier, and I don't know whether the unions had something to do about it,
yeah,
or whether the city was more industrial than here, and
okay,
you know, because this area was a depressed,
right,
a very depressed area in a depressed time.
Okay. What about money back then? Back then, did the money that she was making enable you to get by?
Barely get by. Barely. We had to just cut all kinds of corners. I remember I'd have to, I'd take on maybe a job, like, for instance, that we were renting a duplex and it had a lawn, and I would cut the lawn and trim the hedges and take the trash out. You know, there were, it was a triplex, really, not a duplex. And I got a dollar a month for doing that, and I'd cut and trim the things every week, take
yeah,
the trash up every week. So
yeah,
I got 25 cents a week for doing that, and I would save that towards something that, oh, like saving for my gym clothes, for instance, so that when summer was over with and in the fall I'd have my new gym clothes or gym shoes or whatever. That's how I was able to do these things, you know.
Right.
And being very economical, knowing how to cook and you know, cook certain dinners. That,
so you really had to be careful.
Very much so. Uh-huh. And as far as clothes, I think I had one good dress, and the rest were just school clothes. That was it. Not
right,
how to last.
Yeah.
Because you just didn't. And oh, by the way, another thing that was very hard too was that there was no such thing as credit, buying on credit like you do today.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, everything was cash.
Oh my.
So people didn't own homes as readily as they do today. They didn't have automobiles.
Right.
We had ice boxes. We didn't have refrigerators. Just the people who could afford refrigerators were, you know, the ones who had a
right,
business or were making money.
Okay, well, you mentioned clothing, and then you talked about a little bit about food, about how 50 cents could feed several people back then. What
mm-hmm,
other ways did you utilize?
Everything was cheap. Eggs were cheaper, and everything was
cheaper.
What
was cheaper, the diet like back then for, say, people, an average family? Yeah.
Well, I, being just two in the family, I mean, I could speak,
right,
you know, but like these people that I knew that had the eight in the family,
yeah,
and only one paycheck coming in, and the kids would try to, you know, find anything to do, but, you know, the jobs just weren't available.
Right.
I remember they would have, they'd have maybe cereal in the morning, cooked cereal, you know, and milk. And then at school they'd have, you know, they got help. Now they had, you know, the lunch ticket. And then in the evening, I remember many times they just had a great big pot of soup. And it was just bones, or sometimes it was just bean soup. And meat was a scarcity. Maybe they'd have it twice a month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because to feed eight people on meat, you see, it would take a lot of meat. And generally it was hamburger anyhow, so they really, I mean, the mother would bake their own bread.
Right.
And they just ate a lot of beans, lentils, and spaghetti, and things like that, starchy things.
Okay. Now, this man of the family that was bringing the check home, that, the fact that he had so many mouths to feed would necessitate him really having to have a job. Now, you mentioned before that the employer relations were really bad. Now, a man like that, what do you remember any specific abuses you were hearing about that working men were being subjected to?
Well, just trying to get all they could out of their help.
Right.
All the hours, and to do everything, where they wouldn't have, for instance, if they'd want you, you know, to do your work and clean up as well, and so that way you didn't have a janitor, you know,
yeah,
that eliminated, and I imagine they had to cut these corners to make it a go, you know,
yeah,
and they just, had you, you were like in constant fear that if you didn't put out the time and the extra effort and all the other little bitty side jobs that they expected of you, that you could very well lose your job, and that meant that your family wouldn't have. You were living like under a constant threat, like a sword hanging over you.
Over your head.
And it really demoralized a lot of people. It just had people living in fright, you know. And there's always and I think the moral depression was felt more than actually the economical wasn't. I mean, you know, you can go ahead and cut corners, the economy of it, but when you begin to get the psychological depression, that was terrible, and you didn't know when you were going to come out of it. I mean, there was no hopes of coming out of it.
Right.
And it was very demoralizing. And I think people who had, say religion or had traditions or things to hold on to and believe in that there was going to be a change, I think these are the people that really pulled through.
Right.
I think the good, basically you need, here I go now, I'm not a religious kid, but I think you need good foundations in order to be able to hold on to in times of distress, whether they be emotional or physical or whatever.
Right.
And if you don't have that, you don't have some faith. And of course, being that I'm a first generation of foreign parents, you see, they believed so strongly in America that they just felt that it was going to, something good was going to happen, but they didn't know how or when.
Right. So there was a real fear, though, that something good might not happen, though.
Well, with a lot of people it was, but with a lot of other people they had faith.
Right.
They had faith in their country that something would happen, that something would pull them out of it.
Okay. Well, why don't we talk about that now? At the beginning of the onset of the Depression, Herbert Hoover was the president. You said that your family were immigrants to the country.
Yes. Yeah.
And your friends that you were associating with, how did people feel about him?
Well, you've got to realize that a lot of the foreign people were not exactly illiterate. They knew their own language. They could speak and read and write their own language. Their English was limited. They would read the newspaper, whether they got out of it the true meaning or
right.
of it.
Right.
And a lot of it was hearsay, and of course the radio was a source of information. And I just tried around with the people they worked and everything, exchanged their views, and they felt, or at least they were given the impression, that Hoover was responsible for the Depression.
Yeah.
And they just, well, especially here in California, he was a Californian, you know.
Yeah.
You'd hear all kinds of stories about Hoover, that he didn't want to hire Americans to work on his estate, that he hired Hindus, and I don't know how true that is, but that's the rumor, and it just seemed like he was just something terrible as far as the...
As far as the common man was concerned.
Yes, the public.
Well, the people around you felt...
Well, I mean, even in school, and, you know, they had this feeling about Hoover. And it wasn't until years later that we found out that Hoover really wasn't responsible for the Depression.
But everyone kind of put the whole thing on him.
Yes, that he was a scapegoat.
Right.
And I guess we are doing the same thing today.
Right, that's possible. Well, what do you think might have caused that? Was it the media or just people's ignorance of the situation or what?
I think it was a combination of both. I think it was the media, and I think also that you have to know economics. I think ignorance, misinformation,
right.
hearsay.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you're always willing to give someone else the blame for something that you don't understand, you know.
Right. But he promised that prosperity was right around the corner. No, it didn't mean during the Depression. He said that things were always going to get better,
mm-hmm.
and yet things weren't getting better, though.
No, they weren't.
So that might have caused a lot of that, mm-hmm. right?
A lot of that feeling, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because the only way you could understand if things were better was if your paycheck
things
was better.
You, yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So what would you just say the general attitude towards who it was?
It wasn't at all good. No,
right.
It wasn't. It wasn't at all. I mean, Hoover was just like saying, oh, you know, we have a plague because of Hoover or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a very negativeness about him. I mean, the feeling was negative.
Okay, and this was probably a widespread feeling then.
It was.
Right there.
Uh-huh, very much. So okay. I suppose the more educated people and the economists and everything else, economists, I should say, that were more aware of things and why they happened, but who would hear a few handful of people against the multitudes that were, some were dying of starvation, some
yeah.
were.
Yeah.
We read about it, you know. We read about the big cities, and the bed lines, and the things like
right,
that.
Right, right. So
I can remember certain parts of San Diego when we'd take the streetcar, we'd see certain areas where they would distribute foods, and there would be lines of people waiting to get their quota of flour and staples. And I remember seeing that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then we would see in the movies, you know, the bed lines of New York and the big cities.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Well, what effect did that have on you? I mean, what did you think?
Very depressive. Very frightening.
Yeah.
Very frightening. And you couldn't afford to do the things that you do today. Today, no matter how rich or poor you are, you have your children check their teeth and see the doctor. And we never did that. We just had to stay healthy.
Right.
And a doctor, you just never saw a doctor. And so, you know, some people with a bad diet and not seeing a doctor, a lot of them suffered for this.
Yeah.
You know, all the way around, it was very, very bad.
I see. Okay. Why don't we talk about this, the change that came when Roosevelt was
uh-huh.
elected.
First elected.
Right.
Well, the first thing that I can feel that changed when Roosevelt came in was the fact that he started these different government programs like the NRA and the different programs like getting people off the streets and out of the bed lines and into these camps where they go and build roads, dams, and different government projects.
Right.
And by concentrating on the on the country and bettering conditions like roads and dams and things like that, he was also putting people to work. And this was a good thing because then we didn't have all these people, you know, sitting around and
just not sitting idle. Right?
No, sitting idle and being discontent and breeding discontent.
Right. Okay.
So that was the first progressive move that he made, was getting people employed.
So, okay, then how did the people around you then react to that? I mean, his setting up these jobs, they were created by the government, jobs.
Yeah, well, they thought it was great. And everybody's saying, oh, my son went and, you know, was called out to work with the forest rangers, or my husband is, you know, helping this or that. And you'd hear all these things, and it just meant that they could breathe a little, you
right.
know. They could see a little light, so to speak.
Okay. How did they react, though, to taking jobs like that? I mean...
Oh, they're very anxious.
They were?
Very anxious, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
See, they didn't have Social Security then.
Right.
You weren't compensated for not working.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as Social Security in those days.
Okay.
There was more social insecurity.
Okay. So these people really flocked to get these
oh,
jobs.
Oh, yeah. They thought it was great.
Okay.
Yeah. Everyone thought it was great.
You don't remember anyone thinking about the jobs as a, or hearing of anyone thinking about the jobs as a handout from the government, and they weren't.
No, because you see, it wasn't a handout. It was something that they were participating in and creating. They were creating good highways and roads. They were building dams. They were doing different things. It wasn't just a poor excuse to be working or getting a paycheck. You were doing something, and it was really something. And they had barracks for these men, and they'd feed them, and then, you know, they're on the job, stay out in the country, and then they'd come in, you know, town, and see their families, and they'd have paychecks. Well, this was great. It meant they could eat, meat, and maybe buy an extra pair of shoes instead of hand-me-downs. It was really like a shot in the arm. It really stimulated the people in the country.
So this is all the New Deal legislation that brought this all into effect, and
yes,
that was FDR.
Yes.
So what were the general feelings towards him as the man?
Oh, well, they thought he was almost a god.
Really?
Yeah, they did.
Could you say some more about
mm-hmm.
that life?
Yeah.
Okay, before we took a short rest break there, we were talking about FDR and the people's feelings towards him, and I was just asking
mm-hmm.
you what they were, what you observed them to be.
Well, being at the door of opportunity and jobs and being able to go back to normalcy, naturally the people thought he was almost like a god. And very devoted and very strong supporters of him, and as history proved, he ran for president 3 times with no sweat.
Right.
I'd like to mention something here. In a way, when I think back, and I feel sorry for Hoover, because he made an appearance here in San Diego at Balboa Park at the Oregon Pavilion, and the poor man couldn't even get through what he wanted to say. Everybody was booing him. And it really was very disrespectful because he was our president.
Right.
And then I remember when Roosevelt came, I was in San Diego High School and he made an appearance. And we had worn our different colored middies so that we could make out the words welcome. And the ovation was just, you saw things of Hitler, you know how he used to go, you know.
Right.
You know, the crowds and the waves of, you know.
Right.
Well, that's the way it was with Roosevelt. I mean, everybody went wild.
Right.
Just wild.
And they actually booed him, you remember?
Not Roosevelt.
No, Hoover.
Hoover. Yes, they booed him. The poor man couldn't even finish his speech. I mean, he did, but it was a great deal of embarrassment.
This was when? This was while he was president?
Yeah, before Hoover. I mean, before Roosevelt. This was during, I think it was time of the exposition. I knew the exposition. I think it was before Roosevelt came out. It was that last, that time he was making his campaign speeches.
So.
And,
right.
And then I think that when they went to the polls, naturally Roosevelt got it.
Okay. Right. Okay, let's see. Why don't we talk about the labor unions? You mentioned that your mother was worked in San Francisco, and then she came down here to San Diego, and the conditions were markedly different. They were worse.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Now, labor, could you say how the labor unions in San Francisco, because San Francisco today is still a very strong labor, a union town.
Mm-hmm.
And so could you say from what you heard your mother say, the difference that the labor union made?
Yes, it did, markedly. So like I said, a $10 reduction in pay was, well, my gosh, it's if you were getting, say, $25 and you ended up with $15, you know, that's almost half the pay, isn't it?
Right.
It's a good, you know, I mean, that's a good portion. $10
right.
a week, it's a lot of money. You know, in comparison, it's just...
So the labor union...
And then the food wasn't that cheap here either.
Right.
I mean, in comparison to San Francisco.
Okay.
For some reason, I don't know why, but you'd go to the market and the fruit and the vegetables and everything seemed in abundance and you could buy it. But here, I think it could be possible that bringing things from the valley wasn't that much in production.
Right.
You know, it was very limited to grain and melons, where they had the San Joaquin Valley around San Francisco where there was plenty of everything. I think that had a lot to do to the environmental.
Right. Well, what difference then would you say that the labor union made, you know, in the average worker?
Well, there was nothing here to give the labor any protection whatsoever. You were at the mercy of the whims of the people who employed you. Where it was a labor union, if you did your work and did it right, if the manager on the floor didn't like the color of your hair or whatever, he couldn't fire you because he didn't like you. If you got fired, it was because you were not producing or not doing your job.
Right.
Where here, it could be anything. It just...
And that was another one of the psychological effects.
Yes.
Of depression had on people.
Yes, that's why I always thought San Diego was being more depressed than the depression.
Right.
You know, we had a depression within a depression. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it was hit so hard. Well, why don't we talk about, from what you observed, the reactions that the immigrants had to the depression. Here we have people that left Europe, left the old country, and came over to the United States, and now this horrible thing happens.
Well, you must remember that when they came over here, say 60 years ago, they didn't find exactly things. I mean, they had jobs available to them, but the standard of living wasn't too high at the time. So as time went by and the First World War came and they saw prosperity and everything was high and expensive and everybody making money, you know, during that period, you see, the prosperity and the roaring 20s or whatever
right.
they call, and then they had the depression. Well, you see, for an immigrant who came from a distressed area from the old country, you know, they had their depressions there. Coming to America, finding jobs, and then seeing the progress during those years, and then the depression, they weren't as frightened, I don't think, as some of the native people, because they hadn't seen a depression. In other words, if you came from a depressed area and then saw progress within a new country, and then the depression, you knew that the progress would be there because you had seen it happen. So they had the faith that it would happen again, that progress was a thing that would come about, but it would take its time, you know. Someone had to do it, but the country had great potential. Otherwise, they wouldn't have come here. And they lived with the progress of America. They were part of that progress, you see. They saw changes. They were able to take it.
Right.
Now, of course, and I can't say that about all Native Americans, because there were a lot of them who went through a lot of those cycles and changes too. But when you're living in a country, and you sort of take it for granted, and you just think, well, it just has to be this way or else, you know. But when you come from another country, and you see the opportunities in the new country that you've adopted, you have a different faith, a different strength towards this adopted country, because you are adopting it. No one's forcing you into it. You're not born into it accidentally. You have adopted this country, and
right.
you have faith in it. And you see the changes. You see the progress that has taken place. And then because of a regress, regression, you do not, or depression, if you want to call it that, you don't completely lose faith in the country. You just know there's time that the change will come again and will go up again, which it did.
Okay.
So sometimes it takes someone from the outside to appreciate what we have.
Yeah. Okay, so then these Native Americans then, they said that they were the ones that really suffered the most in that sense.
I think so. Because you see, here they were used to a certain way of living, say over generations, and then all of a sudden it wasn't there. Although I can't say that about everyone, because you get the farming people who've always worked hard and they've always put out, you know, the backbone of our country. I think, I don't think that scared them any. But I think, like in the city people were more scared.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Talking about something that happened back then, do you ever remember reading or hearing, just from talk, conversations that you overheard, of anyone losing all they had and then actually committing suicide, taking that road out?
Yes, there was a friend of my father's in San Francisco that had done that. Committed suicide.
What was the story behind that?
Well, I don't know in detail because I was a child at the time, but I do remember that he had a business and he had all his earnings in the stock market, and he lost all his earnings and was very depressed. I don't know whether he had plans of doing something with his money or whatever it was, but he just couldn't see starting from the beginning all over again. I think it has a lot to do with a person's background and basis. Again, I'm going back to religion and family upbringing, and then too, maybe some people aren't well, or, you know, at the time it, you know, it just hits them the wrong way, maybe certain disappointments in their family life or whatever. And but a person that has good foundations will just fight for survival. And I think you even talk to people that were prisoners of war, you see the same thing. It's up to an individual, really.
Right. Well, how would that help? How did that help people then get by during the Depression, during the really the meanest years of, like?
Just holding on and having faith. I think that is the greatest thing.
Yeah.
Holding on and having faith.
And not just throwing your hands up in the air.
No, never. Never be a giver-upper. Always have a faith and keep going. Because nature changes, times change, and nothing is forever. And if you know this, and you believe in it, and you know that as long as you apply yourself, that you're always bound to come out to the top.
Okay. And
so these things really don't frighten me, even today, that we have certain things happening. It doesn't frighten me, because I know we're going to come through it.
Right. So, so you would say then that, was that an attitude held by a lot of these people?
Yes, very much so.
And that aided
But I can't say that all immigrants felt this way. And I can't say that all Native Americans were the opposite. It's up to the individual. But a majority of immigrants, which I can speak for, were very much strong in their opinion of America's future. They believed in it.
I see. Well, yeah, okay, you said a majority. But I was wondering, this might seem kind of a silly question, but these people that did come over on the boat, did any of them ever think about getting back on the boat and leaving and going back to the old country?
No, because in the old country, even though they had a beautiful country, and they had seen beautiful times, you know, the thing that brought so many of the immigrants here was the fact that Europe was in a constant turmoil of wars. And when a country is subjected to warfare, I mean, survival, I mean, what jobs, there's no such thing as jobs, it's just survival.
Right.
And coming to America, where jobs were available, and where America was never subjected to direct warfare, you know, I mean, we've been involved in wars, but we've never had the enemy over here fighting us and bombing us,
right.
You know, God forbid, but this was the great land of opportunity, of peace and freedom. freedom, to be able to work and come home and live a life without the interference of war, you know.
And so that's what instilled that faith.
Yes, and they could not return to Europe because they knew that even though Europe was beautiful and had culture and tradition and everything else, it was not, you know, a free place. It was constantly under fire, shall we say.
Okay, so this...
And don't forget, America's quite industrialized.
Right.
You know, some of these countries had maybe just one city with a little industry or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, no comparison. Even people who lived in England still preferred America.
So would you say then that during the Depression, the majority were satisfied then with what was going on?
They weren't satisfied, but they weren't frightened. They weren't frightened.
Right.
They were, naturally, they were very careful. They were frightened to a certain extent. Let's say that they were frightened of maybe losing their jobs if they didn't satisfy their bosses entirely, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, personal fright. But they just felt that, as far as America's concerned, that there was going to be a change and it was going to come someday, but when, they didn't know. They couldn't foretell it because they didn't have, say, the knowledge to be able to foretell. I think even some of the educated people couldn't foretell that, you know.
Right. Okay, then. Well, looking back over these years of the Depression, how would you say, from what you observe, from what you know to look back on now, when would you say the worst times occurred, the most suffering here in San Diego?
I would say from 31 to 35, 36.
Right on there, and then on things start getting worse. And so during those things start getting better. So during those years, things were the worst. Like in what sense? The unemployment.
Yes, unemployment. There's just no money, you know.
Yeah.
Available. Jobs, no jobs. People offered their services to work just for a meal. They didn't want money, just meal, just to eat. That's how bad it was.
That, do you actually remember hearing that happen?
Yes.
What would happen?
Well, they would be willing to work for a meal. They'd go out and say,
any
place, yes. Lady, can I cut your lawn, or can I do some work for you and for a meal? And I've heard stories like that even out on the farms. It's just nothing to eat. That's how bad it was. People were sleeping in the parks and alleys. They couldn't afford to pay rent. They didn't have a job. They'd take newspapers and put them inside their clothes and sleep in it.
What about getting evicted from the homes, homeowners that couldn't make their mortgage payments? That must have happened a lot in San Diego.
I can't recall that because, like I say, the people who had homes were people who had businesses. Very few of the employed type of persons could afford a home because you worked for a salary and you lived off of that salary. You never had anything left over, very, very little. If you wanted to save to put down on a home, you had to have quite a bit. There wasn't such things as credit and FHA and things like that, and VA, of course, even though we had World War I veterans, but it was impossible to buy even an automobile unless you had almost half of it or better. And then, jobs weren't forever during a depressed time. So how could a man sell you anything if you didn't know the next week or the next day you'd be working? So credit was just very, very high to get. It's just for those who were in business and had something coming in.
Right.
So that meant that people did not own homes, they rented, And the ones who rented were the ones who had jobs. If you were a businessman, you could own a home because you had a little more money. And of course, homes were that expensive. You know, you could buy a beautiful, beautiful home for $2,000, even $800.
Yeah, a home?
A home, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Money was scarce. Money was hard to come by, so it had a lot of value.
Right.
$1 had a lot of value.
Right.
So this way, you see, they most people just rented. Very few people owned homes.
Rented a home, well, I mean, a little apartment.
So if they were evicted, the majority were evicted from rentals because they couldn't afford to pay the rent. Now, we lived in this triplex, and we were paying, like when we first went there, we paid like $10 a month, a one-bedroom triplex.
Right.
And as time went on, they, you know, as times became better, then it increased. And I think the most we ever paid was $15.
A month?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is 1937 or so, 38.
Uh-huh.
All right. One other thing I want to ask about, the banks closing during the Depression. There was a Bank of Italy in San Diego, wasn't there?
Yes.
And it did shut down.
I don't know that it did. I know the Bank of Italy in San Francisco, which became Bank of America.
Right.
It was Giannini's bank. And he started in San Francisco right after the earthquake, the big earthquake. And it was called the Bank of Italy, and it became the Bank of America.
Right.
So I don't know whether it shut down entirely, whether it was converted into the Bank of America.
Okay. But, you don't remember the banks completely closing it?
Oh,
losing their money.
I've heard of people, again, I'll say I was a child, and I heard of people saying that they had money in the bank and they couldn't get their money, you know. So it was bad. Like this man, this one person we knew that committed suicide, he was a businessman. Maybe he banked at a bank that closed down, lost all his money in the stock market, and just was so depressed that he couldn't, you know, see his way through.
Well, those people didn't have any recourse
no.
to anything back then.
No. No, they didn't. It was really quite frightening for some people.
See, as I say, in the early years there, 30, 31, there was no, you were on your own, right? No relief at all from the government?
Mm-mm.
In any way?
None. The only relief was for the people who applied for relief. And some areas, I think, I don't know now, I may be wrong, but I think if you weren't an American citizen, there were a lot of things that you could not enjoy.
Oh, I see. So this is another problem of immigrants.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What about say discrimination in whatever jobs there were available towards these immigrants?
I don't think there was too much. Now, you must remember too that San Diego, it was a border city. In most border cities of Mexico, the standard of living is lower for the reason that your Mexican help works for a lower scale.
Right.
And we didn't have that in San Francisco. I think that was another main factor.
Right.
And that might have been one of the reasons why salaries were so cheap down here, besides the fact that it wasn't a union town.
Right. Well, would you say did you notice that the immigrants were being relegated to the lower paying jobs,
No, I would say that they weren't available to them as much, as readily as other people.
Right.
Not okay. That the pay was different, because, I mean, if a businessman was just barely making it, regardless what color, what, you know, you had to put out.
Right. Okay. So then during the Depression, though, did you ever witness any bitterness towards the country experience by people? You mentioned that people were bitter about Hoover. Do you ever remember anyone saying anything derogatory about the country?
I can't say that because I wasn't exposed to anything like that. As I say, you know, the people that I was surrounded by were people who felt that they just had to go through this crisis and that everything would work out eventually. I had not such a negative atmosphere like some people might have had. Like I said, I explained my background so that, but I imagine these were the seeds of communism, really, for a lot of sections, maybe a lot of people, you know.
Okay. So why don't we talk about the
The what?
So why don't we talk about the attitude that we describe later about the faith that the country would snap out of it. Now, you mentioned there wasn't any bitterness back among the people around you. Could you go over that just one more time about, okay, we were in the depths of the Depression, I say, 1931, 1932. What, I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to fathom, what would make people think that things were going to get better? There was no relief from the government.
Well, I told you, from the people that I was exposed to, they came from a distressed country.
Right.
They came to America. They found jobs, which they couldn't find in their own country because it was not industrialized. There was progressiveness in America. They could work and save and do something for themselves, either save and go into a little business or something and build up from that. And they built up and they reached a certain point. And then the Depression hit. So they had to regress back to a certain point. But they had progressed with this country. They had started from nothing up to something. So going back, regressing, did not really frighten them because they knew that this country had so much more to offer than Europe and that they would come back up again, that the tide would swing.
Okay.
You see, because when you can't appreciate America unless you've gone to another country and lived and seen what people are limited. They're very limited in other countries. They don't have the opportunities we have. Today they're far better than they were 50, 60 years ago. Through the aid of this country again, because immigrants sent money back to their homeland, they helped their families back there, their grandparents or parents or whatever, and America has helped these countries, which in turn, of course, is the American taxpayer is, you know, putting it out.
Right.
So actually, we have been the bloodstream of many countries. We have given life directly and indirectly to many countries.
Okay.
So if people can come here and help their relatives in the old country, what is the Depression going to do? It's not going to frighten them. It's just a challenge.
It was just a challenge then,
yes,
people.
Yes. And then too, you have to have faith, you have to have foundations, you have to have religion, you have to have trust.
Right.
And then there was a sort of a joke about being poor and about not being able to afford it. We took a sort of a, you know, I mean, we just laughed, you know, try to make the best of it. We had movies that sang songs about depression and and there were entertaining musicals and things like that that kind of gave you a lift, and everybody just sang the blues, if you want to use that expression, in a very happy beat.
Everybody was in the same boat. Huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I see. Okay then. Well, looking back, did you see any beneficial effects of this occurring again, say, in my lifetime? I've not, you know, been living high of that,
uh-huh,
so to speak, you know. No.
Well, I see that because I was a child of the Depression, being a child of the Depression and having scrimped and saved, and not saved really, you couldn't save, you just scrimped to exist, And then saw the change come on. You begin to appreciate the things that were forthcoming. And then, of course, the opportunities, banks being guaranteed not to go broke. I mean, we had an incident here recently, and people were protected. They didn't lose their deposits or savings. And having the government come through and stand behind the people did a lot for the people. And it just surged and it became greater and more beautiful. And credit, you know, that was introduced.
Right.
Then loans and FHA and VA. And this gave everybody an opportunity to become a landowner or a homeowner or whatever. And to be able to own an automobile and different things. It just put the country, just actually the Depression, it was just a basis to shoot higher for a higher standard of living.
Okay.
It really was the foundation for a higher standard of living throughout America.
Because the country just took off from right there.
Yeah. Then they knew what they wanted and how and everything
else. Okay, well, what about the lessons that it? Did it teach you any lessons that you think would be good for me to learn?
Well, I started to say that being depression and having worked and everything, I wanted, there were things that I wanted that I couldn't have because I couldn't afford. And so when times were good for me later, and I got married and had my child, I wanted to give my child those things that I did not have.
Yeah.
And even though it pleased me to give to my child, it also spoiled him and made him take not only his country for granted, but his family and his home and all the things that he was given for granted. And he had no comparison to say, well, I don't know what it's like to be in a depression. I've never seen one. I only read it in a book. So he had, in other words, if you've never gone hungry, you don't know how good just a plain old hamburger will taste.
Right.
So if you have prosperity all the time, you're not going to appreciate prosperity.
Okay.
And, you know, it's...
So that'd be the lesson, just a general appreciation of more of what
yes,
we've got.
Yes, and I think that... we have to strengthen our home and our foundations for a lot of our youth. I think it's wonderful that they explore, because we did too. We thought a lot. We didn't act upon it because we were limited. You know, you needed money to get into a streetcar, which you didn't have. I'd walk to school to save a nickel. Today, kids have automobiles. They can go anywhere. They work and make money and fly anywhere. Well, you see, the opportunity to make money is here. So that, in a way, proved to be very good, and it proved to be very bad in some instances because they didn't know how to use their money or to appreciate what money was doing.
Okay.
It was something they took for granted again. It's there. It's abundant. Kids now go out, $5, it's nothing to blow a little grammar school kid, a little show or something. $5 is gone, where $5 years ago meant the very life and existence of a family.
Right.
So you can't blame the kids. I think we, the Depression children, are the blame for it because we wanted to give to our children those things which we did not have and so desired and dreamt about. So we live through our children.
Right.
And then we cannot blame them for what they do today. It's not their fault because they don't know the difference. There's no difference.
Right.
But I think those of us who have given our children good basis, moral upbringing, religion, and even though they may go out and try different things because it's, you know, everything's so wonderful, so now they're going to try this, and then try drugs, and try everything else. I think even though they stray, they'll always come back to their foundations.
Right.
If they don't have those foundations, they have nothing to come back to. They're lost. And money isn't the answer either.
Okay, then. Well, then, would you say that the depression occurring in, say, the lifetime of someone who doesn't have these foundations would help?
Would you repeat that again?
Would you say that if the depression occurred in someone's life who doesn't possess these good foundations, do you think that it would be beneficial to them, or would it be disastrous?
It would either make them or break them. They'd either have to develop character,
right,
or they would, go off on the far end. And
right,
I think this is where drugs have gone, to the far, far end,
okay,
where these kids do not find happiness at home or understanding. Or there's a gap, naturally. I mean, we have lived our lives, and now we want to sit back and enjoy the beautiful sunset, where the younger generation want to get up with the morning sun and create and do and explore.
Right. Okay, well, I think we'll close then on that note. And I want to thank you, Mrs. Perry, for your thoughts and your comments.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're welcome, I'm sure.